America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Blackwater hiring a new PR firm, or actually bringing one in-house to put the mercy back in mercenary. Say what? There may be a new VA secretary. Bush is actually nominating somebody and going to go through the process. James Peake. We'll have more on that as the story develops. And Dick Cheney went to a hunting lodge with a conservative battle flag hanging. We'll see if that turns into anything. I don't know. A lot of the news, which we will be getting to as the day continues. However, it is that season. Seattle SeaTac Airport has already announced they're determined to avoid another war over Christmas. They're going to go pagan. They're putting out a winterscape. In the meantime, over at WorldNet Daily, WND.com, the website, Joseph Farah, the founder, editor, and CEO of WorldNet Daily and author of Stop the Presses, the inside story of the new media revolution, is offering your very own War on Christmas kit to fight back the war on Christmas. Joe, first of all, welcome to the program.
Now, wait a minute, Tom. Wait a minute. It's a Christmas defense kit. It's not a Christmas war kit.
It's a defense against the war on Christmas, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. We have labeled it correctly, named it correctly. You're right.
And we have tapped into a groundswell of opinion across America, apparently. It's a very popular item. I mean, it basically consists of a bunch of bumper stickers, magnetic bumper stickers that you can switch around in your car. And one says, "This is America, I'm going to say it, Merry Christmas." Another one says, "It is still a wonderful life, Merry Christmas." And the last one says, "Merry Christmas, an American tradition." And, you know, I don't think they're very controversial. They are apparently hitting a chord with folks. And isn't it wonderful that we live in a country where everyone can have their say and express themselves like this?
I don't disagree, and I don't find these all that controversial. What baffles me is that it seems to me that the real war on Christmas was really launched a week or two ago when George Bush vetoed a bill that was absolutely consistent with Christian values. When are the Republicans going to stop the war on Jesus' values of helping the poor, feeding the hungry, you know, healing the sick, visiting those in prison? I mean, you know, instead of simply waving phony flags made in China.
Let me answer. Christians do that every single day in America and all around the world. But Jesus never prescribed Caesar to do these things. This is an individual responsibility for Christians.
And he never suggested Caesar shouldn't do those things either.
Well, he sure didn't ask Caesar to do anything, as far as I can tell.
I am not suggesting, Joe, that we as a nation should be doing anything because it's in Christianity. Because you'll find the exact same things that Jesus said in Judaism and in Islam and in Buddhism and Hinduism.
Where in the Constitution does it suggest that we should, that the federal government should be doing things to help individual people? Show me any place that even hints at such a thing.
All right.
And please don't cite the general welfare clause, because general welfare is not helping individuals. It is not transferring wealth from one person to another.
How do you help the general welfare without helping individuals?
Well, that has been over the many years, going way back to Thomas Jefferson. Lots of debates about this that you can still read. But there's a consensus among many that it's things that help everybody. For instance, a highway system helps everybody. It doesn't help an individual. It shouldn't. Of course, now the way we build highways, it helps private corporations.
If that's the case, then why did in the George Washington administration, and then renewed in the John Adams administration, and then renewed during the Thomas Jefferson administration, why was legislation passed every other year that renewed money for poor houses, for housing and medical care and food for the poor in the United States?
I'm not aware of that, but
it was consistent. In fact, James Madison was the first guy to veto it, and he vetoed it because when he came into office, the clergy was getting more and more powerful. The Jefferson had been essentially, they viewed him as their enemy, and he had kept all this stuff secular. It was the government running government programs or giving money to the states to run government programs. And there was a bill, and this was his first veto, Madison's first veto. There was a bill that said, let's give this money to the churches to do it. And he said that this would be breaking the separation of church and state. This would be an absolute sin against the Constitution. He said this should be a secular process, period. The state should be providing money for the poor, not through the churches. It's fine if the churches want to do that, but we, the people, we as a nation have an obligation to these people.
Again, I would also cite the difference between helping poor houses, which is helping general welfare, and transferring wealth to individuals with a check, a welfare check, that, you know, that there's a difference. I'm sure you see the difference in these two things.
Well, I see collective individuals as society. I don't think that, you know, I don't understand how you can separate the two.
I thought we were going to talk about the Christmas defense kit, by the way.
Well, you know, we did, and you gave a great, great pitch for it, and people can find it over at WND.com. But my point is, it seems to me that speaking as a Christian, it seems to me that conservatives who love to wave that flag do not cleave to Christian values and don't want our government to participate in Christian values. They want the Christian rhetoric. They want power for churches. They want power for billionaires like Pat Robertson, who's a diamond smuggler.
That's true of some people, but you got me all wrong. See, I think the institutional churches are part of the problem. I think that they have abdicated their responsibility to help the poor. This is really something that Christians have to internalize. You know, we as a Christian, Tom, you know, we serve a God who can do anything, who can make miracles happen. And it seems to me that when you read the totality of the scriptures, what you see is he wants to get us off our butts and do something as individuals, not pick somebody else's pocket. That's not compassion, but to actually empty out our own pockets of our own free will to serve our God and to serve our neighbors.
Right. By
That's
their works they shall be known. I mean, it's the parable
of the vine and the fig.
He
doesn't want us to get the Rockefellers to do it, which we're never going to do anyway.
So then why would we say, if we collectively as a society have this institution that is us, that we call the government, right? In a democracy, the government is us. Unlike, you know, the old Soviet Union kind of thing. In a democracy, the government is us. Why would we not want to say one of our responsibilities is to protect the most vulnerable among us?
Well, I think we do. We should protect them. We should protect their lives.
Then why would you guys vote against the S-CHIP bill? You know, there are children who are going to die as a consequence of Bush's veto. I don't understand how he can sleep at night.
Well,
why are you laughing? I'm not exaggerating.
Explain that to me. How does that work?
There are children whose parents cannot afford health insurance, who will not go to the doctor, or who will get treatment so late that it will not be effective, or will not be able to get treatment, and will die as a consequence of their diseases because they do not have access to health insurance because their parents don't make enough money to pay for it, because we have privatized insurance in this country, the only country in the industrialized world that has it. And this program would have expanded that insurance to about 8 million more children, and there will be. I tell you the absolute truth, Joseph, and I defy you to prove me wrong. There will be children who die as a consequence of this.
I will right now. Number one, you know, expanding the federal government's role in our health care system is exactly the wrong way to go. We live in a country where anyone who needs medical attention gets it. And by centralizing the power...
According to the Bush administration, $18,000...
You will be the one killing children. It's just that simple.
By providing them with health insurance.
What's that?
I'm killing kids by providing them with health insurance?
Well, you won't be. You'll be rationing it because the government always does that. That's what happens in Canada. That's what happens in England.
We ration health insurance in the United States. According to the Wall Street Journal, we ration it based on wealth.
How many times do we have to see this experience? Anybody who needs medical attention walks into a hospital today, and the people who are the poorest don't pay anything at all. It's the middle class people.
Joseph, you have never walked into an emergency room in a big city hospital. I guarantee you, if you're saying that.
I certainly have. I was born and raised in big cities, and I was very poor, Tom, and I know exactly how it works.
You would not want to be waiting 20, 25 hours for medical care in a big city hospital emergency room. It's hell.
All right, Tom, but you know, let's not call each other murderers.
I'll give you that, Joe. Okay, I'm pointing at Bush, not at you. But anyhow, Joseph Farah, WND.com, WorldNet Daily.
God bless you. Merry Christmas.
God bless you, and Merry Christmas to you too, Joseph.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Congresses were liberal democratic.
They all hugged trees.
Banned DDTs.
Refused to be pragmatic.
Then voters said our state is red, our message is emphatic.
We want some moral values and a Congress theocratic.
We're super zealous radicals against all things atrocious.
We like Fox News.
They share our views.
And Coulter is precocious.
If you cross me, you'll quickly see that we can be ferocious. We're
super zealous radicals against all things atrocious.
Hold on here. Hey, wait. You know, you don't have a corner on moral values, all right? Our state is blue. We don't like you. We won't give folks a fair chance.
We'll brag to you of our IQ while yours is like a pear plant.
We've got degrees like PhDs. We don't like your unfair rants.
You started wars, and what's more, you don't like SpongeBob SquarePants.
That's the culture wars. The war on Christmas starting early this year. Seattle Times reporting, Susan Gilmore, have a merry winter time. It says, and there won't be a Christmas tree or menorah displayed at Seattle-Tacoma International Airport this holiday season. Instead, the decorations will be what designer Rudy Trostel calls a winterscape, a collection of handcrafted birch trees surrounded by lights and nestled in a pseudo-snowbank. So we're featuring peace and harmony, says Mike Feldman, the deputy managing director at the airport. We're using lights. Winters are so dark and dreary. Yeah. Well, see, what they're doing is they're going down the pagan road now. I can see it now. Seattle SeaTac Airport. And we're on the air in Seattle, so maybe this will be a clarion call. They're going to have a pagan Christmas, because after all, it is the winter solstice. I mean, the real holiday, the ancient holiday, is the winter solstice. What is that, December 22nd, December 23rd? It varies from year to year, I think. But the frame that I want to place around this, and frankly, I think that progressives and Democrats should get out ahead of this. I mean, they should be saying Bush has declared a war on Christmas. Conservatives have declared a war on Christmas. There is a war on Christmas going on, and it's a war on Christian values in the form of legislation, the form of vetoing the S-CHIP bill, which, by the way, I just don't get it. If the Republicans can figure out this twisted, distorted way to pass a bill that takes away our civil liberties and come up with a long, lengthy acronym that spells out USAPATRIOT, U.S. Patriot Act, and it's got, I don't know, maybe somebody in the chat room can send me the quick link to what USA Patriot stands for, but it's some long thing, protecting our territory, blah, 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 blah. Why couldn't the Democrats come up with something that spells out helping our children or the Safe Child Act or the Healthy Children Act? Why do they have to call it S-CHIP? I mean, come on, guys. Learn about messaging. Learn about framing. This is not rocket science. There's something that can be done here and can be done effectively and can work, and it's not being done. I mean, it's just, this is so straightforward. But in any case, in my opinion, we could actually get out ahead of this curve. You know, Bill O'Reilly doesn't have the corner on the war on Christmas. We could get way out ahead of this curve and by saying things like, why is the administration declaring this war on Christmas? Why are they declaring a war on children, for that matter? Why are they going after the most vulnerable among us? These are not Christian values. They're not Jewish values. They're not Hindu values. They're not Muslim values. They're not Buddhist values. They're not even animist or pagan values. They're selfish values. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that the whole con thing is all about, we're the rich and we got our riches and screw you. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Now, I am not at all opposed to people becoming wealthy. I think it's a fine thing. In fact, I think it's a desirable thing that if people work hard, they can make a good living and they can earn enough money that maybe even their children and their grandchildren will never have to work. Although, frankly, I'm not sure that that's a good thing for their children and grandchildren never to have to work. There's this phenomena of the third generation crashing. It's a fairly well-known thing that it happens a lot, that the third generation in wealth crashes. And I think that, maybe we're seeing it in the Bush family. George is the third generation in that family. The Kennedys actually, Jack and Bobby, of course, they were the second generation. Now the third generation is like Bobby Jr. But the Kennedys did it differently. They did it the way that the British nobility did, which is teach your children that you have great wealth and that differentiates you from everybody, because that's impossible to ignore, but that also gives you tremendous obligations. In England and countries with royalty and things, it's called noblesse oblige, the obligation of nobility. And so the Kennedys were raised with this belief that the highest thing that they could do, particularly given the fact that they had all this wealth, was to serve the people. Obviously a message that never got down to the Bush children. It was never adequately communicated. And so George W. Bush thinks that his job, if he can get into public service, is to help his rich buddies get richer. I'm sorry, that is the war on Christmas. You want a real war on Christmas? Look at the behavior of this administration. Look at what they're doing. It's got nothing to do with whether or not Walmart says Merry Christmas in their signs. I mean, that's a distraction. It's a canard. They're trying to focus our attention someplace else. Move it away from it. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
I was raised on God and country. Here I take my stand. You and I are we the people. We're the law in this here land. Stand by JFK against the covert plan. I know that secrecy is on American. They can take their oligarchy with them down to hell. I'll keep the Constitution and that old Liberty Bell.
Yeah, the Constitution and that old Liberty Bell. Those are my icons. 34 minutes past the hour. Well, I've got a few others as well. 34 minutes past the hour. Strange goings on out there in the worlds. Maybe Texas is. A commission put together by the state government compiled a 668-page report. Took 18 months, canvassed over 170 agencies, and concluded that the state is producing too many reports. I kid you not. Strange stuff. So what's the real war on Christmas? What's going on here? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Charles in Indiana on the line. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Tom. One of the things the gentleman that you had as your guest wanted to us to mention areas in the Constitution which said that the government helps people. Well, how about securing the blessings of liberty? If you don't
to ourselves and our posterity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our posterity is going to be rather unliberated or won't really enjoy any liberty if they're sitting around there fighting everything just to get a scrap of food.
And the simpler argument is that the Constitution explicitly gives Congress the power to appropriate and spend money however it damn well pleases, frankly, to use the Anglo-Saxon, which means if we the people decide that we the people want to, say, provide ourselves with health care or provide ourselves with Social Security or whatever, the Constitution does not forbid that. It absolutely provides the right for that.
Yep, and of course the other part is we also have to talk about securing our domestic tranquility, and I guarantee you that's why we used to call the Latin American countries the bananic republics, because they had a revolution every week, because no one was employed, everyone was in poverty except for the wealthy families that ran those countries and still do, and why we still have problems there and in Burma and other places.
Yeah, well said, Charles. Thank you very much. And now we're becoming a banana republic. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world, and the largest importer of raw materials. We were the largest creditor of the world. We are now the largest debtor in the world, and we are now the largest importer of finished goods and the largest exporter of raw materials. So we're now shipping out the ore and the raw materials and the trees and things, and we're bringing back in furniture and finished goods and computers and cars, and we are now in debt up to our eyeballs. We are now the banana republic. Sharon in Georgia. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, Tom. I don't know who the guest was either, but I just caught
Joseph
him.
Joseph Fry was his name.
I caught him saying that we do have insurance in this country, and, you know, anybody can go to an emergency room and get treatment. And, yeah, that's true. You know, if you have a gunshot wound or you're in a massive car accident, yeah, you get treatment. But, I mean, my son is in that kind of a situation. He's had a hernia for like a year. It's to the point now where it's out of control. So we're going through the Medicaid route, and, you know, if that doesn't work, then if you get rejected, then you can go to some kind of a charitable organization, see if they can help you out. My grandkids are all recipients of that Peach Care here in Georgia, which is the SCHIP program here.
Right.
And, I mean, their parents work. You know, but if you make $14 an hour and it's going to cost $300 a month out of your pay to pay for health insurance, the choice is between feeding them or insuring them. I mean,
Right. It's
just not possible. And I can't believe that people could be so, I don't know, like you said, it's so mean-spirited. You know, what are we asking for? We're asking for care for children. You know, how can you call yourself a Christian and just not think that's so wrong to deny children health care?
You said it very well, Sharon, and I wish your son well. And I mean, this is, you know, half of all bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical problems. I mean, this is obscene in what used to be the richest nation in the world and still one of the richer nations in the world.
Right.
It's just absolutely obscene that we're not providing for our people. Sharon, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I was an emergency room physician for several years in a large city hospital, and I would love that man that you had on previously to go in there with a little four-year-old child vomiting and diarrhea when the place is packed. We used to have no room in our operating suites. I had to go out in the office and open a woman's abscessed tonsil she had just in the room where she was sitting. This man does not know what he's talking about. He's so characteristic of so many Republicans. They call themselves Christian, but they are not. I told you this once before. If I had to have a heart transplant, I would like to have Republican, because I know they've never been used.
Okay, David. Yeah, let's not pick on Joseph.
I think
he's a decent guy and well intentioned.
Anyone,
I just think these guys are blinded by their ideology.
And again,
not speaking specifically of Joseph.
Another example, who wrote that book, Goddess. If she's an example of God, they call me an atheist.
Yeah.
Because what she said about the gentleman from Carolina who's running the candidate, Edwards, he said she had a bumper sticker put out, "Tell me about your dead son again." She was responsible for that.
I know.
I mean, how
yeah, it's It is, you look up mean-spirited in the dictionary and you see Ann Coulter's picture. I don't disagree. But again, let's keep it to the issues, not the people. Gene and Sanford, but thank you for your comments and for your service as a physician in emergency rooms. I have a very good friend who worked in ER, as a physician in ER, in ERs for, the better part of a decade, and it's a real burnout job. It was really tough on him. Gene in San Francisco, California. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Merry Freedom of Beliefmas.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Yeah. But that man, your guest, he seemed to think that what everybody else has been talking about children not suffering, I'm glad you pointed that out so strongly.
Well, I just think that's the real war on Christmas. There is a conservative war on Christian values that is going full tilt boogie, and they're trying to divert our attention away from it by saying that stores aren't saying Merry Christmas. Who cares if a store says Merry Christmas?
Yes. You know, the other part about that is that not only will those children suffer because of those... Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, you're still there. Yeah.
Yeah, you're still here.
But the what's going on also in Bush's policies is he's already cut off the disabled. So many disabled people have already died. And also, something that's ongoing with our culture is the loss of coverage when people have a work injury. Work compensation in this country, it's uneven state by state. But in many states, as soon as a person is injured, they're just cut off from any kind of care other than the care they got for their injury, even if they get that, and they may not.
Yeah, and excellent point, Gene.
This tangentially touches on something that I'm really concerned about. We all pay taxes to advance medical research through government grants and university support, and yet only the wealthy benefit by many of these new advances.
Right, mostly the corporations. What happens is we pay the tax dollars. It goes into the National Institutes of Health. They fund the research. The corporations end up with the patents. Used to be that the government ended up with some of those patents, and a lot of the money came back to the government, and then it would get recycled into NIH. Now, increasingly, it's just going back to the pharmaceutical companies and the manufacturers of medical products. Andy in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. But I'll get better. What's up?
I guess my point is that gentleman that you had on the show, he was very mean. He laughed and you said kids would hurt. And I think that represents a larger segment of the right-wing population. They just don't
care. Andy, I just have to defend Joseph Farah. I really don't for a minute think he was laughing at sick kids. I think that my argument caught him off guard, and, you know, I've laughed in inappropriate moments. You get caught off guard, and that's what you do. The guy is not heartless.
Maybe so, Tom, but I think that, you know, I think that shows his true colors, though, unfortunately.
Well, I don't want to make the discussion about Joseph Farah. He's a decent guy, and he thinks he's doing the right thing. And I think most of the readers over at WorldNet Daily believe that they're doing the right thing. And what we have here is a disagreement about what's the best way. I know that most conservatives would like everybody in America to have access to health care. I know that. I mean, I've talked to enough of them. They're on the program regularly. And most liberals believe that. And the question is, how do you best accomplish that? And they believe in this mythical thing called the free market. And they believe that corporations, because they are answerable only to the morality of profit, and they are not answerable to we the people, that corporations are morally superior to we the people because people are inherently flawed. That's the fundamental conservative worldview. Whereas liberals believe that if you have the maximum number of people participating in governance, because people are fundamentally good, I mean, there are a few of us who are pretty screwed up, but basically we'll make the right decisions and we'll care for ourselves, and therefore government has a role in providing health care. I mean, that's the essential cleavage between the conservative worldview and the liberal worldview. We're both trying to ensure as many kids as possible, save as many lives as possible. It's just a question of which way to do it. And you look at the last 26 years since Reagan started rolling back the New Deal, what you see is that more and more poverty, more and more people dying from preventable diseases, more and more kids who have no insurance. That's the bottom line, and that's the real war on Christmas.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Children are being left
behind as the Pentagon spends more. While millions have no health care, it wastes billions waging war. Corporate puppeteers pull the strings and chart the course as public servants sell us out without remorse. When public servants serve themselves and forget who's serving who.
And this weekend on Saturday, I'll be keynoting the Holistic Management International Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And also on Saturday, November 3rd, I will be at Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. It's at the Northwest Quarter of Tramway and Candelaria, for those of you who are listening to us in Albuquerque. And that'll be at 5 o'clock on Saturday. We'll be signing our new book, Cracking the Code. And on Monday, November 5th, here in Portland, Oregon, I'll be at Powell's Bookstore on Burnside at 7:30 p.m. And Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show with us on AM 620 KPOJ, will be introducing me there. So should be a great time. 1-866-303-2270, our number, John, speaking of Portland, Oregon. John in Portland, what's up, John?
Yes, I felt like the guests wanted to have it both ways in promoting just the certain Christian values he wanted. An important part of Christianity is tithing, and that's everybody combining their money together to help the community. And when we
do that in a secular way, it's called taxes.
Exactly. So the to refer to Caesar is ridiculous because we are Caesar in a democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the difference. Jesus did not live in a democracy. He lived in a dictatorship or a kingdom and a despotic dictatorship. Excellent point, John. Thank you very much. Ira in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ira.
Hi, Tom. I love you, but I have to disagree with you about creating wealth. What we have is a system which legitimizes itself by producing a surplus by destroying the basis from which that surplus arises. Feasting
that
on
being the commons?
The golden egg. The tragedy of the unregulated commons. And we don't create wealth, Tom. We transfer it from one system to another, usually labor or nature, and we transfer it from the natural systems of wealth, like the forest, to capital systems, which are questionable.
By and large, Ira, I absolutely agree with you, although I would submit to you that there is intellectual capital as well, that we do, you know, for example, moving from an oil-based economy to a solar-based economy, moving from something that's destructive of the commons to something that has less impact on the commons, would be actually creating genuine wealth because it's diminishing our load on the commons. Would you not disagree?
Well,
would you not agree?
I think that there's a unity of opposites with wealth. There's the commonwealth and then there versus private wealth. And I'll give you a wonderful example. There's a book called The Redesigned Forest by Chris Mazur out here in Corvallis, you know, the Oregon State University. And he has his table of contents gives 10 examples of how nature designed the forest. I don't know if I should read all of these, but he says nature designed the forest.
No, you can't.
Okay.
But I get your point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I get your point. You're absolutely right. It's natural capital that we're moving from. And the other one that makes me crazy, I heard twice this morning on the radio people talking about this corporation is going to create jobs. I see these ads. Walmart creates jobs. I'm sorry, nobody creates jobs. If you, in the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, a company come along and said, we're going to create jobs, everybody would have laughed at them. You don't create jobs. You hire people to make a profit on their labor. That's what corporations do. They hire people and they make more money from that person's work than they pay that person. And that's how they stay in business. And if they make a lot more money on that person's work than they pay that person, then they show extra profits and the CEOs get to take huge salaries and they pay stock dividends and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, this is not rocket science. Karen in Florida. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Going back to your Mr. Farah and some of the arguments, and I know you wanted to take it off of what he actually is saying, but the larger premise of children being able to get care if they went to an emergency room. I'm a former emergency room nurse. Now I work in AIDS healthcare, so I'm knee-deep in it. And I can tell you, and I'm sure you already know this with your background, is that children decompensate so quickly. You can take a child to an ER with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, that kind of thing, and in a half an hour they could be critical. And that's not to say they're going to get the care they need, because in those crowded emergency rooms, and it doesn't have to be in a big city. I worked in a small city ER, and it's the same everywhere. But the piece
plus, there's such a social discouragement against using ERs that many diseases that have relatively benign early symptoms and very quickly become critical, the parents will not even take their kids in because they realize that they're going to face a hostile bureaucracy. What are you doing here in my emergency room?
Exactly.
And the kids just get sicker and sicker. Or the early symptoms that if you had full health care, you might check out, that, you know, easy bruising or something that could be an early symptom of leukemia, doesn't get checked. And,
exactly.
And then, you know, by the time they find out, well, gee, it's too late now.
Exactly. And it just, you know, speaks to the larger issue, just on an own personal level here in the state of Florida. I have an adopted daughter who is on Medipass, Medicaid, and they changed the formulary of the epilepsy medicine that she is on. Medipass is it's part of the whole Medicaid program, not necessarily an HMO because they're experimenting with that in Florida as well. But the particular program she is on is just plain Medipass. And she was on an epilepsy medicine, which when Jeb and the boys were in power in Tallahassee, took off the formulary, and Representative Joseph Peden in our state, Representative Republican, when he was asked what effect that would have by taking that drug off the formulary, he stated and was quoted in the Tallahassee Democrat newspaper, "Well, nobody I know is going to die."
By taking something off the formulary, it means that they're no longer paying for it.
No longer paying for it, yeah. It was a $700 a month medicine that my daughter needed to take, which took us 3 years to get to that level. You know, with epilepsy, it's not just pick this one, pick that one. It's a matter of degrees.
Right.
And
individualized.
Exactly. So, you know, that I just wanted to say, it speaks to a larger, not just the person that you were interviewing, but the whole premise of that. They just don't care. And they don't care that they don't care.
Yep. Karen, thank you very much for the call. And again, not to vilify Joseph. I think he's a decent guy. I disagree with his policies. But I am saying, and I'll say it unambiguously, the war on Christmas has begun. It began when Bush vetoed the S-CHIP bill. Coming up next, how long are we going to continue to allow Republican policies to poison our kids?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Yeah, in the chat room, some discussion about how over at 620kpoj.com, there's this poll, this presidential straw poll, and among the writing candidates, my cat Higgins is doing really well. And I keep saying, you know, I'm sure he's pleased about it, but he's right behind Al Gore right now. But like last night, you know, I went upstairs to get a snack, got a handful of potato chips. Higgins nearly took part of my hand off trying to get a potato chip. His two favorite foods in the world are potato chips and pizza, because he grew up in his kitten years, tortured and beaten and abused and locked in the bathroom for much of the time in a fraternity house, and has developed some very bad habits and strange tastes as a consequence of it. You don't want Higgins for president. Anyhow, for this hour, our question, how long are we going to continue Republican policies? Well, really conservative policies. This goes beyond Republicans. You know, it was Bill Clinton who really kicked the door open to this with NAFTA and GATT. Democrats have been on board with much of this all along, that allowed China to own us and poison us. Now, the own us part, I would say the own, O-W-N, us, U-S, part, is, as opposed to onus, although I suppose it is the onus of the Republic, is the Republican end of it, in large part. I mean, this is Ronald Reagan deciding that debt didn't matter. Dick Cheney saying, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. Well, what Reagan proved was that future generations will pay the interest on your debt, and if you run up a huge debt and spend that money, particularly if you give it to your millionaire and billionaire friends, they will keep you in power, and a little bit of it will trickle down into the economy, to the point where people will say, well, the economy doesn't look all that terrible. But do we really want to have an economy based on the defense industry and based on debt? I mean, that's ultimately a disaster. The defense industry, while, you know, I'm the first to acknowledge that we have to have a strong national defense, the defense industry in and of itself is producing things that, by and large, are not productive. You build a bomb and you drop that bomb on some other country, the $5 million that bomb costs is gone. On the other hand, you put $5 million into a school, and it's probably going to produce $30 or $40 million over the 30 or 40-year lifespan of the school in terms of tax revenue coming from people who got an education because they were attendees of that school. Just for example. Or if you want to keep it in the commercial field, if you are building tools or machinery or cars or transportation, you know, I mean, there's so many things that you can build that have secondary benefits, that have long-term value, that have long-term use, as opposed to the defense industry, which almost exclusively produces things that are made to be destroyed. So Reagan began this thing of let's have an economy based on building the defense industry. $3 trillion to his buddies for the so-called Star Wars program. A whole bunch of Republicans got very, very rich. And what did we ever see out of that? Pretty much nothing. And no, Reagan didn't bankrupt the Soviet Union. Back in the 60s, the CIA was predicting that by the early 80s, the Soviet Union would be gone. And in fact, it didn't collapse even on Reagan's watch. It was Jerry Ford's watch. People forget. No, it wasn't Jerry Ford's watch. It was George Herbert Walker Bush's watch. Right after Reagan, when the Soviet Union actually collapsed. But for some reason, Reagan gets credit for, you know, go figure. But it wasn't really either one of them, and it certainly wasn't conservative economic policies that did it. No, it certainly wasn't defense spending that did it. The Soviet Union had been falling apart for the better part of 40 years, slowly and steadily. So the economic policies are wiping us out. They're allowing China to own us, and not only own us, but now we are so in debt to them that we can't take them on in any kind of serious way, and we're giving them all of our manufacturing. And in giving them our manufacturing, they're giving us back what? Well, this is from CBS News. Based on the inquiries by CBS News and the complaint filed with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, there's now an official investigation into why some ugly teeth, that's the product name, in quotes, ugly teeth, have levels of lead 100 times beyond the legal limit. These are the phony teeth, you know, with the phony fangs and things that kids buy and they put on and they wear for Halloween. Thousands of these things, perhaps tens or hundreds of thousands of these things have been sold all over the United States. They're made in China, and they have these incredibly high lead levels. This is just one of many products. Professor Jeff Windenhammer decided he's just going to go out and start testing lead levels. You can get these little lead testing kits in hardware stores. You know, they're mostly designed to test for lead paint in your house. It's like a little felt pen, and you rub it on something, and if it turns a certain color, it means that there's lead in it. And so he just started testing stuff. Out of 56 Halloween-related products he tested, he found six of them to have between 4 and 130 times the allowable level of lead in them. All six of them made in China. At the same time, in India, The Gap has been selling products now to their credit. Once this was exposed, they said that they were going to stop. But nonetheless, up until it was exposed, and you would think that they would want to be the ones to figure this out and stop it long before some public service did. But in any case, child workers, this from The Observer, The Guardian in the UK, the child workers, some as young as 10, have been found working in a textile factory in conditions close to slavery that produce clothes that appear destined for Gap Kids. That's a brand name, one of the most successful arms of the high street giant. Speaking of The Observer, the children described long hours of unwaged work, that is, no wages, as well as threats and beatings. The Gap said it was unaware of this, and it has withdrawn the garments involved. But it raises renewed concerns, quoting again from Dan McDougall's piece in The Guardian, renewed concerns about the outsourcing by large retail chains of their garment production to India, recognized by the United Nations as the world's capital for child labor. According to one estimate, more than 20% of India's economy is dependent on children, 55 million youngsters under the age of 14. This is, you know, just terribly, terribly grim. At the same time, so here we have products coming into the United States that are the result of slave labor. We have products coming into the United States and being sold in the United States that have very, very high levels of lead. The cons will tell you this is a wonderful thing because it means that corporations are more profitable. In fact, for example, this is from the Financial Times, Peter Marsh in London reporting. The headline says, China and India will shield General Electric from U.S. downturn, says Immelt. Now, here's essentially what the CEO of GE is saying. GE is a, you always think of GE as a U.S. corporation, right? They own NBC, they own MSNBC, or a good chunk of it. They're a defense contractor, they make nuclear power plants, they make jet engines, they make all kinds of stuff, consumer appliances. They own companies that own companies that own companies. But the fact of the matter is that more than half of the business that General Electric does is done outside the United States. And they're actually quite proud of that. They're saying, is there, the question is there a recession coming in the United States? Or are we already in a recession? Most people in the middle class would say that we're already in recession. What they're really seeing is the result of 26 years of conservative economic policies. Reagan rolling back the New Deal, shredding the social safety net. And the biggest part of it was Reagan dropping the top tax rate in 1982, I believe he did it, from 71% down to 27% or 29%. I forget which it was, but down to less than 30%. But here's this article. The head of General Electric, the world's biggest industrial conglomerate, bet you didn't know that, says a slowdown in the U.S. economy is unlikely to be a problem for the company because the strength of emerging economies such as China and India. This is what I've been saying all along. These companies, they don't care about America. If America goes to hell, that's fine. We've got other countries we can go to. Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO, in an interview with the Financial Times, said that in spite of the troubles sparked by the credit squeeze, quote, outside the U.S., particularly in China and India, economies appear strong. In the world as a whole, there's still a lot of liquidity, he added, saying that there's every prospect of GE sales outside the U.S. expanding in the next few years by 10 to 15% annually. Mr. Immelt, GE's chairman and chief executive, said the company's sales in emerging markets such as China and India were expanding at 20% per year, and there were a few signs of the growth slowing. Some economists say this is evidence that for the view that the European Union is passing this year as the biggest destination for Chinese exports and rapidly rising intra-Asian trade. I'm telling you, 10 years from now, the European Union is going to be looking around going, what happened to our countries? Mr. Immelt said it's also important to take into account the impact of sovereign wealth funds. These are huge pools of money owned by governments like communist China. Oh, don't worry. If the U.S. can't invest in us, they will. I'm going to tell you about that right after the break. It's getting even weirder than you thought. Stick around. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
Liberal, 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 liberal.
21 minutes past the hour. So here we have products coming into the United States laced with poison. Then there's no really other way to describe lead in a product that's designed for a kid to stick in their mouth like phony teeth. Laced with poison. Poison that will take years, perhaps decades, to work its way out of their body. And all the time that it's in there will be doing neurological damage, literally dumbing them down, causing behavior problems, and possibly causing a whole wide range of other physical and physiological problems, as well as the neurological damage that lead does. We have these products coming into the United States because they're being manufactured in countries where we don't have control over the raw materials and over the manufacturing process like we would have in the United States, because we've offshored all that stuff because it's more profitable for big multi and transnational corporations. And the only agency that we can look to, since all of us don't have the ability to walk into a toy store and say, okay, I'm going to take out my little trusty lead kit and test every one of your toys before I decide what I'm going to buy, the only thing that we can do is we can turn to the organized us, government and say, would you guys please check this out so we know what's safe? And please check it out, in fact, before it makes its way to the store shelves. I mean, Consumer Reports can do it after it's been on the store shelves, and then you got to wait a month for the magazine, and it takes a month for the investigation. So 2-3 months down the road, you discover it. So that's fine for, you know, what's the best plasma TV. But if we're talking about what is going to kill my kid or what is going to cause my kid to drop 3 IQ points if he puts this thing in his mouth for Halloween and these phony teeth, I'm sorry, the free market provides no remedies. None. So we have this thing called the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And George Bush and the Republicans have put into place, as the acting chairwoman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, a woman by the name of Nancy A. Nord, who I assume is a very nice person. I mean, after all, she used to be a senior official at the United States Chamber of Commerce, the lobbying agency for large trans and multinational corporations. Two of my companies, by the way, over the years have been members of the Chamber of Commerce. I've been to Chamber of Commerce meetings in both Georgia and New Hampshire, and one of the things that I got out of it is that, you know, there's this patina. There's this sense of, oh, yeah, we're cool, we're local, it's local business. But really, at the national level, at the lobbying level, at where the money is really going, it's the agenda of the big corporations. And before that, she was a lawyer at Eastman Kodak. And her proposal as the acting chairwoman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission is to ask, she sent two letters asking members of Congress not to improve legislation that would increase her own agency's authority and power. Not to pass legislation that would double her agency's budget, and not to pass legislation that would increase her dwindling staff. Instead, she said that a proposed provision, let's make this law to ban lead from all toys, not a good idea. She also said that companies that knowingly sell defective products should not be subject to criminal prosecution. And she said that her agency, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, it should not be easy to force her agency to publicly disclose what they know about what products are faulty. What is going on here? Tony Fratto, by the way, the White House spokesman, says the White House shares many of her concerns. In the meantime, some of the biggest U.S. private equity firms you've all heard about, for example, the Carlyle Group. George Herbert Walker Bush was either the chairman or CEO or something like that for a while, and the Bush family heavily invested in it. One of the largest owners of defense contracting stocks in the United States. One of several large private equity funds is what they're called. Selling out a good chunk of themselves to, guess who? China. This from today's Financial Times. Three of the biggest U.S. private equity firms have each held preliminary talks about selling a minority stake to China's giant Social Security fund. Yes, China has Social Security, and federally. It's a national program, just like ours is, and they invest their Social Security money, and they're thinking of investing it in the Carlyle Group, along with KKR and TPG. The talk suggests that the number of Chinese official entities looking to make investment in foreign material financial firms is poised to grow. Bear Stearns of the U.S. and China's CITIC Securities last week revealed plans to invest $1 billion in each other. So companies in a communist dictatorship, owing and beholden to a communist dictatorship, are buying a significant chunk of one of the companies in the United States that owns a good chunk of our defense industry.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Call in America, right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 866-303-2270, our number. Drop by our live chat room at TomHartman.com and many other cool things. You can also visit our blog at AirAmerica.com. Click on the Tom Hartman page. It'll get you to it. Cheryl in Los Angeles. Thanks for calling, Cheryl. What's up?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I love your show. It's absolutely incredible. All
thank
the information
you.
That you pass out. But I wanted to recommend to your listeners, and I don't know if you have done so in the past, to watch a movie called The Corporation.
When that first came out a number of years ago, they were doing a remake of it for the CDs and had invited me to be interviewed, and it ended up our schedules didn't work, so I didn't get on it. But it follows pretty much the same course that my book on equal protection does. Not that there's necessarily cause and effect. I mean, it's pretty obvious to anybody who does the research. But yeah, the rise of the corporation and the movie does a brilliant job of laying it out.
It just, you're in shock when you watch it because the realities of what goes on. But I would also encourage listeners that, and I have an investment group with a group of women, and we invest in green stocks. We research companies that do the right thing and represent our ideals. And we can make money in the process of it. So there are good corporations out there, and it takes a little bit of research, but that represents my ideas of environment and sustainability and healthy lifestyle, and we make good money doing it. So,
oh, good on you.
I would highly recommend to people, if they do want to invest in the stock market, to invest in corporations that are doing the right thing, because they're not all bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's well said, Cheryl. Thank you very much for sharing that. The other thing, though, to keep in mind, and this is a tough one. If a company is doing an initial public offering, they're actually raising money to grow their company. So when Google, for example, went public and they did an IPO and they let people buy their stock, that money went to Google. So if I bought money on the Google IPO, which I tried to do and I couldn't figure out how to make their website work, and so I ended up not ever doing it, and I'm still kicking myself about that, that I would have been giving money to Google. On the other hand, now that Google is selling for whatever it's selling, $500 a share, if I go out in the marketplace and I buy, 100 shares of Google for $50,000, that I'm not giving $50,000 to Google. They're not seeing a penny of that. I'm giving that money to the person that I'm buying the stock from. So when you're buying and selling stocks that are not IPO stocks, it really has no effect whatsoever on the company, or very little effect. I mean, if you're a huge institutional buyer and you're buying a large chunk of stock, you might be able to slightly increase, or if you're selling, slightly decrease the stock price. So it's at that point, it really becomes more of a moral statement than an investment strategy. But I'm all in favor of moral statements as well. I think that people need to protect their portfolio and not feel terribly guilty if they're invested in, for example, mutual funds that might be in the wrong place, or even stocks that are not companies that we think are the very best companies, unless you're buying an IPO in the company, and then in which case the money's actually going to the company. But most people, I think, don't get that subtlety. So anyway, Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian. Brian, you are on the air. Brian is not there. Okay, let's go to Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Tom. I wanted to talk about Chinese labor law and American corporations.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an attempt to reform labor law in China. Now, it's very moderate. It doesn't give Chinese workers the right to form their own independent unions, independent of the government and the party. It doesn't allow them to strike, but it does, and I quote, strengthen workplace inspections and force employees to consult with workers' representatives over job cuts and tighten the enforcement of minimum wage, etc.
You know, in 1975, the country that had the tightest regulations on the amount of radiation that could be emitted by a microwave oven in the world was the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And yet, if you walked around with a meter near their microwaves, they would pin the dial wherever you went. Just because a company, just because a fascist dictator or communist dictatorship says that they're doing something doesn't mean that they're actually doing it.
But let me finish this. This is a law that is proposed, and industry associations, the American Chamber of Commerce in China, the U.S.-China Business Council, and the European Chamber of Commerce are all opposing the new Chinese labor law, which would, you know, increase the minimum wage and enforce it better and allow workers to somewhat negotiate. Now, this is amazing because what you have, and I don't call the Chinese government communist. I think they're actually a fascist government, but, you know, for very technical reasons. But never mind that.
Sure. But they call themselves communists. So.
Yeah, they call themselves communists. In reality, they're fascist because by the classic definition of fascism in Italy in the 20s, you have one party which controls business, labor, and government. That's
right.
Classic fascism. But anyway, what's happening is that American corporations and, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in China represents all of the largest corporations in America, are conspiring with the most reactionary forces in China to hold down labor costs, to hold down wages in both China and the United States, and by extension, all over the world.
Right, which blows a hole in the meme, the thought virus, the idea that has been put out aggressively by think tanks like the American Heritage Institute and the Cato Institute since the 70s and 80s in large part, that the more you have unregulated laissez-faire capitalism and the more widely you spread it around the world, the more you're going to have democracy. And the fact of the matter is that unregulated laissez-faire capitalism actually works at its greatest efficiency in a dictatorship.
Exactly. And to further, these same corporations, the American corporations, are the backbone of the Republican Party. These are the people who finance the Republican Party.
And they're growing in the Democratic Party. I mean,
let me
play for you a very short clip. This is mind-boggling, but this is John Edwards' Day Before Yesterday. And just listen to this, Lawrence.
And today, Senator Clinton has taken more money from Washington lobbyists than any candidate from either party, more money than any Republican candidate. She has taken more money from the defense industry than any candidate from either party.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not the Republican Party only.
Yeah, no, you're right. But these companies...
She's taken more money... Hillary Clinton has taken more money from the defense industry than Rudy Giuliani.
Okay. But these companies who are essentially the backbone, the real government of the United States, who finance, you know, using both parties, finance the government of the U.S., these are the parties who are conspiring with essentially the Chinese fascists to hold down wages and to destroy labor standards, including safety and health and chemical standards all over the world.
Yep. Well said, Lawrence. Thank you very much for sharing that. And in fact, this is why I say it's even stupid to say, oh, let's have trade agreements that have protections on labor and the environment. Okay, so they start making stuff in a clean way, and they're paying, you know, labor union wages. Well, a good middle-class wage in China might be $6 an hour. Might be $4 an hour. It sure ain't $20 an hour. How can you still can't compete? It is every country has different, they have different natural resources, they have different populations, they have different cultures, there are so many differences that it is entirely appropriate to create a membrane around an economy through the use of tariffs the way we've done it for the last 200 years up until the last 20 years to protect a country. I mean, it's just, call me a protectionist. I'll be the first to raise my hand. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice.
Hi. I'm calling in regard to goods coming in from China. The holiday season is coming upon us, and I would caution parents not to buy any wreaths or Christmas decorations made in China because of the possibility of lead poisoning in those. They can go to their local farm markets, get fresh greens, be imaginative. And I myself am boycotting all Chinese goods. And I have found that if you spend the time and do the research, you can buy American.
Yeah. Okay, good point, Bernice. Thank you very much. Yeah, and the problem is that, you know, lead is easily bent and easily twisted. So a lot of these decorations, you know, wreaths and things like that, where things are bent and twisted around, are on wires that are, if not all lead, certainly some percentage of them lead alloys. Richard in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Tom, thank you for signing my book, Breaking the Code, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome.
I just had a comment about Alan Greenspan when he was hawking his book, that one asked about Clinton's basic financial program and then George Bush's. And then he comes out in his book and he condemns George Bush's basic programs. Correct me if I'm wrong, you know much more about it than I do. But when asked what he invests his money in now, he would not say. I just find that non-answer speaks volumes.
I can virtually guarantee you that Greenspan is investing his millions in euros, in Swiss francs. These guys are no dummies. In Canadian dollars, in Australian dollars, in New Zealand dollars, and in probably gold and oil, and companies that are mining or storing gold and oil in those countries or in those currencies. Because
that's the feeling I got.
The guy knows which way the wind blows. He's no dummy. He knows which way, you're welcome. And he knows which way the wind blows. He spent 20 years taking apart the middle class in the United States. Alan Greenspan quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying part of his job as the chairman of the Fed was to maintain a certain minimum level of worker insecurity so that there wouldn't be demands among workers for higher wages. Great. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Dealing in dreams here on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. In just a moment, we're going to have Victoria Jones on. But first, just a 30-second little clip. The news that you didn't hear from one of the major Democratic presidential candidates. I guarantee you this was not covered in the corporate media because the corporate media and big pharma and big, they're all the same. And this was John Edwards yesterday, if I can make my clip work.
The reason we don't have universal health care today is because of drug companies, insurance companies, and their lobbyists in Washington. They stand between you and the health care that you need. We have to take this system on. We have to change it. We have to be willing to be honest about it. And I don't believe you can change that system and bring about what we need on health care, on energy, and everything else unless you're willing to say it's broken, it doesn't work.
Amen. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hello, Victoria.
Well, hello, Tom.
Always nice to hear your voice.
Yes. I'm sorry?
Yeah, always nice to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. Good to talk to you. The president is not happy with Congress. He doesn't think it's getting its work done. For some reason, he chose today. Why that would be, I don't know. Maybe there's something he doesn't want us to be focusing on, and he wants to divert us from that. Or maybe he just feels that today is a good day to do it. It's a Tuesday. He feels that Congress isn't getting its work done. It says it has the worst record in 20 years. And he also, I thought, was very interesting. He says the Senate's wasting valuable time taking up the children's health insurance bill, but he also said that basically that he criticized Congress for talking about the S-CHIP bill because clearly they don't have the votes. But he basically seemed to be saying that there's no point talking about an issue if you don't have the votes. In other words, there's no point doing it from a point of view of principle.
Right, because he will stop it anyway. I think that if they pass this thing, if this thing passes through the Senate, even without a veto-proof majority, when the veto comes back, they may be able to muster a veto, a veto override.
I think
that's entirely possible. Yeah. I think that they had a veto-proof majority in the Senate last time. I think it's the House where they've got the problem, and it's only about a dozen votes. And I suspect that there's a lot of Republicans who are not going to have the stomach to sustain a veto the second time on this bill, particularly as it gets more publicity. And by hearing Bush do this, now, first of all, we all got the memo, at least those of us in talk radio, that, some 4 or 5 months ago, that the Republicans' strategy was to block legislation, particularly in the Senate, so that the Democratic agenda, which was very ambitious, Nancy Pelosi, over 1,000 bills have now passed the House of Representatives, which is a record over the last, 30 years? I mean, it's some kind of amazing record, the amount of legislation that's passed, a lot of good things, and it's all being bottled up in the Senate. And the Republicans' strategy was to bottle this stuff up in the Senate and then accuse the Democrats of being a do-nothing legislature and have the president play the role of Harry Truman, who ran against the do-nothing Congress in, 48?
Right.
Yeah. So apparently Bush is rolling out that strategy today.
And just how effective it will be, it'll be interesting to see. I was listening to the CBS News at the top of the hour on the all news station here in Washington, D.C., and there was absolutely no mention of anything that he had to say at all. There was some mention of the man whose name I've forgotten, I'm sorry to tell you, who he's going to be nominating to be the new head of Veterans Affairs, who is a physician, the first time that we've had a physician actually in that position. But there was no mention of any of the things that he said this morning. So I suspect that this is possibly something that isn't going to get as much coverage as he would like.
Right. That would be Dr. James Peake.
Thank
FYI.
You.
Yeah. And we're waiting to find out what the deal is with him, because he's a Bush nominee. I mean, it's got to be a problem, right?
There's got to be something in there somewhere. He's going to be on record as having said something quite extraordinary. We can be sure of that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or screwing up something terribly, you know, so that Bush can say heck of a job.
Well, he may have had a press conference at some point in his life, you know, who knows, or he plans to have a press conference. The one good piece of good news out of the administration, as I'm sure you've talked about, is that the guy from FEMA who was involved with the press conference did, in fact, not get the job at National Intelligence. Now, he didn't get fired, admittedly. He works for the government. He didn't get fired. But he did not get the job at National Intelligence that he was hoping to get. That, I think, is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So you said he didn't get fired. So does that mean he is jobless, or he is in limbo, or what?
I think he's in limbo. I don't think he's exactly jobless, because I don't believe that he had resigned. I don't believe he'd resigned. But that actually hasn't been spelled out in any of the stories that I've read, exactly what his current status is. But he had not been fired. Nobody's been fired over this.
Yeah. Interesting. Dick Cheney, by the way, we were making jokes about Dick Cheney, going hunting. It's, look out. Yeah. Apparently the Clove Valley Rod and Gun Club, where he went hunting, hangs a Confederate Stars and Bars, the battle flag, which is widely viewed as sort of the racist flag of the Confederacy. I mean, it's not actually the official national flag. It's the battle flag over one of their windows. There's a picture of it over at thinkprogress.org.
That's lovely.
This used to be the kind of thing that would be a problem for a politician. Cheney doesn't seem to be bothered by it.
I don't think anything's a problem for him. I mean, when your ratings are in the single digits, what can be a problem for you?
Well, there is that. There is that.
Really?
Yeah, I point out more people believe in aliens negotiating with the United States than like Bush, and people say, what, you don't believe in aliens? Well, actually, I think I've seen a flying saucer, and I'm sure that there's other intelligent life out there in the universe, but I still think that Bush is doing a lousy job, so what can I say?
Not much.
Yeah, yeah. Other news out of Washington, D.C.?
It's a quiet day, really, in Washington, D.C. Congress continues to plod on. People really are reacting to what the president said and kind of scratching his head as to why he got up on his hind legs and said it today. That seems to be the big question. Why today?
Okay.
What's going on behind the scenes?
I'm curious, as the week goes on, how Senator or Congressman Waxman's and Conyers' investigations are going, if you have a chance to look into those things for us.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com.
Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. Now, here's an interesting little piece of news for the day. I mean, aside from all the other news that's out there, the political news, as it were, Bush trashing Congress. Surprise, surprise! Ari Fleischer, a modern-day Moses. And Norman Poderitz. I should know how to pronounce his name by now. He's been a guest on this program two or three times. He basically has said that if you don't want to bomb Iran, you are appeasing Hitler. Norman, I'm sorry. Hitler is dead. In any case, you know, the broad and strange news that's out there. In addition to that, and Cheney going to this hunting lodge and whatnot, and the editor of a newspaper in Baghdad, a weekly newspaper, just murdered this weekend. It's, you know, some grim news overall. But on top of that, this interesting story, Carlos Slim. Carlos Slim is the richest guy in the world. And today's Financial Times has a story about this. The way that he became the richest guy in the world, he's a multi-billionaire, certainly the richest guy in Mexico, and arguably the richest guy in the world, one of the top billionaires on the planet, is by buying up what had been the government telephone company in Mexico. When they privatized it 16 years ago, when you had, you know, Vicente Fox, when they basically brought in what we would call a conservative, what Europeans and South Americans refer to as a liberal or neoliberal government. And they sold off many national industries, and he bought up the telecommunications industry. And so for 16 years, he's basically owned the monopoly phone company. Right now, 91% of all telephones in Mexico are owned by this guy. You know, if you use a phone in Mexico, you pay your check to Carlos Slim. And then he started investing in the wireless companies because they were growing like crazy. And he now owns 77% of all wireless. 77% of all wireless subscribers in Mexico pay him. And Mexico is not a small country, and it's actually a fairly wealthy country. It's one of the five largest exporters of oil in the world. It's, yes, they have a lot of poverty. But, yes, they also, particularly given that they've been following Reaganomics for the last couple of decades, they've got a lot of poverty and a good-sized handful of billionaires. So here's what I find interesting, is that they are now thinking of investigating. Now, let's keep in mind, they're talking about investigating. They're not doing it. But they probably will. Investigating whether his telephone companies are a monopoly. When are we going to come to this in the United States? At what point in the United States are we going to look around and go, hey, wait a minute. We have how many oil companies controlling all our oil and all our gas and all our refineries? We have how many companies controlling our financial services? Well, to answer it, you've got a handful. I mean, literally a handful. Somewhere between 4 and 7 oil companies probably control about 80 or 90% of all the oil and oil products in the United States. Roughly equivalent number of companies own the majority of the financial transactions that are going on in the United States, the banking and whatnot. An equivalent small number of companies own the majority of insurance that's going on in the United States. An equivalent relatively small number of companies control the majority of what's going on in the United States with regard to health insurance and health care. I mean, what we are seeing is the cancer stage of capitalism in the United States. And in self-regulating organisms, in all living systems, there is something that prevents, essentially cancer, it prevents individual organs or individual cells from growing out of control. And when that mechanism breaks down and one cell starts dividing at an uncontrollable rate and creating a mass that gets larger and larger and larger and consumes more and more of the nutrients of the entire system, the body, until eventually it's consuming so many of the nutrients of the body that the other systems of the body can't get enough nutrients and they begin to fail, that's called death by cancer. And it's similar in economies. And this was recognized in the United States. I mean, when we started, we had an economy that was basically small business and farm-based back in the 1700s. And companies, in order to form a corporation, your first purpose for corporation had to be to serve the public interest. You could only conduct one type of business. If you wanted to do two different kinds of business, if you wanted to have an oil company and a corn company, you had to, a farm, you had to have two separate corporations, assuming that you wanted to incorporate the farm. Let's say you wanted to do a factory. I mean, they didn't even have them back then, basically. The early corporations, when the Civil War was started, there were fewer than 2,000 corporations in the United States. The early corporations, by and large, were created to do large things that couldn't be done by sole proprietorships. Things like the Erie Canal. You know, they created a corporation to do the Erie Canal. It had a 20-year lifespan. Corporations could not live longer than the productive lifespan of a person. It varied from state to state, but typically was between 20 and 40 years. If a corporations were not chartered at the federal level, it required literally an act of Congress to create a federal corporation. So there are a handful of them. Amtrak is one example. But they're few and far between. The word corporation does not even appear in our Constitution because the founders didn't want there to be federal corporations. They didn't want any corporation to have national power. They wanted every corporation to be under the control and the watchful eye of local, at the very least, state authorities. And so to create a corporation, you have to go to the Secretary of State of a state and say, we'd like to create a corporation in your state. May we have permission? And they will look at what you're doing and look at the paperwork you're filing and either say yes or no. And if they say yes, then you get certain tax benefits and certain liability immunities. And there's all these benefits that come along with creating a corporation. And it used to be in the United States, in exchange for those benefits, there were certain obligations. And the Secretary of State every year had to look at what you were doing and say, is this serving the public good or not? And if it wasn't serving the public good, they gave the corporation the corporate death sentence. And literally hundreds of corporations in the founding of this country up until the 1880s, every single year, hundreds, in some cases thousands of corporations got the corporate death sentence. John Rockefeller's Standard Oil of Ohio got the corporate death sentence in Ohio. In the 1880s, it's why he left Ohio and went to start the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, because Ohio said, what you're doing is illegal. Well, it was illegal in New Jersey at the time, too, and Connecticut and Delaware and New York and every place else. And so Rockefeller said, okay, I got a pile of money here. I'm going to pay a lot of taxes to some state. What state wants to change their charter rules, their corporate rules, so that I can come to that state? And Connecticut said, we will. And then Delaware said, well, we'll give you even more flexibility, Mr. Rockefeller. And then New Jersey said, well, we'll give you even more flexibility than them. And New York said, no, we'll give you even more flexibility than that. And then New Jersey said, well, we'll top everybody else. And at that point, everybody said, okay, that's it. We're not going to compete anymore. And he moved to New Jersey. And then over the next 10 years, the battle continued. This is referred to in history by corporate historians and historians in general as the charter mongering era. Because the barons of industry, the robber barons of the 1870s and 1880s, were playing the states off against each other. Which state is going to make their charters, their state charters, more corporate friendly? To the point where by the end of the 1890s, you could create a corporation in Delaware, for example. More than half of all the companies on the New York Stock Exchange are incorporated in Delaware. I've started two corporations in Delaware. And the reason why is because in Delaware, one person can create a corporation and get all those corporate benefits and all those immunities from liability. And you can say for the purpose of doing business, instead of having to describe in detail what you intend to do, you can simply say, this corporation is chartered to conduct any business that is legal in the state of Delaware. It's that simple. And it's cheap. And so it's one of the major sources of revenue for Delaware. So anyhow, in the 1880s, as this was happening, the United States Senate got it. We've got a problem here. These corporations are running out of control. And so in December of 1881, Senator Sherman of Ohio introduced Senate Bill No. 1, the Sherman Antitrust Act, to prevent corporations from getting so large and so powerful that they could overwhelm government, that they could destroy democracy. And that basically kind of kept things in check. Up until Reagan came along and stopped. Well, actually, up until Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt started enforcing it. Teddy Roosevelt did for a short while. And then Reagan pulled the plug. 16 minutes past it.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Oh, look out, Rudy. Robert Greenwald is on to you. This is Rudy Giuliani's Clint Eastwood moment. I'm telling you, Robert Greenwald, the realrudy.org and bravenewfilms.org. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
It is always so great to have you on, Robert. You're doing such great work and have been for so long with Brave New Films, the founder of Brave New Films, in addition to all the great things you've done in your career. Let me, let me play just 50 seconds from you, this new clip about the real Rudy on the radios. Okay with you?
Please.
Okay, here we go.
The firefighters on 9/11 were carrying precisely the same radio that had malfunctioned during the response to the 93 bombing at precisely the same location.
And this is something that they knew from 1993, that in the Trade Center and in buildings that size, the radios just were not adequate.
I lost my son Jimmy on 9/11. From what I heard from people that survived, that they saw him up around the 30th floor, and he never made it out. He never heard the call to get out.
I blame this totally on Rudy Giuliani. He knew they had a problem with those radios. Why didn't he do something about it?
It was well documented that these radios didn't work, and the signal wasn't strong enough to communicate.
So, tell us about this, Robert.
Well, we at Brave New Films became aware a couple of months ago that there was this whole incredibly painful and absolutely outrageous story that Rudy Giuliani, who was running for president on his record 9/11, in fact had made some terrible decisions that deeply affected and cost the lives of firemen. We talked to investigative reporters, we talked to experts, we talked to families who'd had their sons killed on that day, that in 1993 there was a terrorist attack in New York, the radios for the firemen did not function properly, lives were lost. 2001, 8 years later, Giuliani has not fixed the problem, their attacks, and the firemen literally were not able to communicate because it was the same radios. And the video lays out the facts and is asking that after all these years, there finally be an investigation. Why was the contract given to Motorola? Why was there no bidding? Why did the Giuliani administration do nothing about it? And in this case, Tom, I think we have a real chance because we've had so many people sign the petition and so many views, and I hope your listeners will join us. I think we have a very strong chance to actually force a hearing and investigation to happen.
And the website, of course, is therealrudy.org or bravenewfilms.org. I'm assuming you have a link from there over to it.
Yes.
We're talking with Robert Greenwald about his new film, The Real Rudy. And Robert, one of the things that I learned recently, and I might have learned it from you, I'm not sure, is that Rudy Giuliani chose to put the command center for 9/11 into it was Building 7, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Into the World Trade Center after the World Trade Center had been bombed, and against the advice of all of his advisors. And the day after he made that decision and signed the contract, the owner of the World Trade Center, and was his name Robert Silverman or
Silverstein? Yeah.
Silverstein. Yeah. The day afterwards, took Rudy out on his yacht and gave him $100,000 campaign contribution, or at least that's the story that I saw reported. I can't verify that that's accurate from my own knowledge, but
it is accurate. We researched it in the video we did before this one, The Real Rudy Command Center. We found absolute authentication through Wayne Barrett's great research that there was a contributor, Rudy leased space, and then there was a $100,000 fundraiser for him.
Yeah, okay. So I did learn it from you guys. I thought I had. And is there a similar sordid tale, do you think, with the radios?
Well, the facts we know are that Motorola essentially received a no-bid contract for a radio that was not functional. A radio, by the way, that was never tested. It was given to firemen, the new radio, and it had never been tested, and therefore was a complete failure, and they had to pull it off completely. We don't know if there were campaign contributions from Motorola to Giuliani or to Giuliani partners. We do know, however, that it's unacceptable for somebody to be running for president on the basis that he did these incredible things when he made some horrific decisions where his administration was asleep at the wheel.
You know, the most powerful way, I think, to bring down Giuliani is to simply run a piece of video of him walking down the street, that iconic video of him walking down the street, kind of half holding a mask to his face, looking very presidential or whatever, and have the voice under it say, the reason Rudy Giuliani was on the streets was because he didn't have any place else to go. His own command center, against the advice of his advisors, had been put in the World Trade Center in exchange for a $100,000 campaign contribution, and he was on the street because he was homeless. He had no place else to go. And it will completely blow up his ability to use that video in the future in campaign commercials.
Well, that's a great idea, and we're gonna do it.
Yeah, re-anchor the meme or re-anchor the visual is how you, you know, the phrase from the advertising business. Anyhow, Robert Greenwald, therealrudy.org, bravenewfilms.org. Robert, God bless you. It's great work you're doing. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom, and I look forward to talking with you again.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's going to be a busy weekend and week next week. On, the third Saturday of this coming weekend, I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm keynoting the Holistic Management International Conference, but for those of you who want to drop by and visit, I'll be at Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. signing my new book, Cracking the Code. And on November 5th, on Monday, I'll be doing the same that evening at Powell's Bookstore here in Portland, Oregon. And on November 9th, on Friday of next week, we'll be with 1480 KPHX in Phoenix, an event and book signing at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills in Tempe from 3 to 5 p.m. And for that, you need a ticket. They're on sale over at 1480kphx.com, the website for the progressive station, the Air America station in Phoenix, Arizona. So check it out. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com will get you there. Our blog over at airamerica.com. Lee in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Oh, wow. Oh, yes. Hey, Tom, thank you for what you do. And I wanted to get your views and opinion on and the feasibility of something. And it's basically four bullet points and then a question. Okay, you tell me what you think of this. If we were to find a constitutional scholar who cannot be easily dismissed because, you know, he has the credentials to say, yes, this is what the Constitution says, and have that individual list in no uncertain terms who, when, where, and to what extent individuals have violated the Constitution, right? Basically have it a two-column listing. So
do you realize, Lee, what you're describing is the job description of the Supreme Court?
I understand that. But here's what I'm saying. It's obviously not happening. I was looking at this, and I've been discussing it with many people, and I'm recognizing I don't have the credentials to not be easily dismissed. Okay. But my point being the fact that even the most stubborn, illogical thinkers that I know, when the facts are facing them straight in front of them, they have a hard time to deny it. My point is, put this list together and then make sure that it's available to be either read on air and or posted in every conceivable location you can think of. You know, make it the facts, obviously, just the facts, and leave all the personal biases out of it. This is the facts, because what's happening in Iraq is the people are breaking apart because of their personal secular thinking. But in the United States, one of our greatest strengths has always been we're Americans first. So if we all agree that the Constitution is what set the United States on the road to, you know, prosperity that it was on, then that should be the bottom line, the defining factor. Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. But again, that, I mean, we there's a semi-evolutionary process for that, and that is somebody gets to be enough of a constitutional scholar, enough of an attorney, enough of a wise elder that they can be nominated by the president to be on the Supreme Court. And then you have elected representatives of the people, the Senate, that has to evaluate that person and hold hearings and question them at some length and then vote on whether or not they should be on the Supreme Court. And so, you know, in theory, the Supreme Court is that. And the fact that you have these 5-4 decisions indicates that it would never be possible to find one person, and I wouldn't want to invest in one person that kind of power. I think it's good to have that kind of debate, and when arguments are made before the Supreme Court, they have to be factual. They can't be, you know, emotional, or they shouldn't be anyway. So, you know, what you're describing is the Supreme Court. My concern is that if we were to try to go outside that realm, that we would be violating the checks and balances that the founders put into place in the Constitution. The focus of our attention in that context, Lee, I think should be instead, let's get good people on the Supreme Court who actually honor the Constitution. You know, the conservatives run around yelling and screaming about activist judges, but the fact of the matter is that the Rehnquist Court and the Roberts Court have overturned more laws and thus are more activist than was, for example, Earl Warren's court before them. The so-called liberal courts, if you go back and look over the last 150 years, you'll find that the times that the courts were, quote, liberal were the times they were less likely to overturn laws and less likely to, quote, make laws from the bench than the times that they were conservative. It's the conservatives who are the activists. And because the president is the person who proposes that you know, each person to be on the Supreme Court, our vote indirectly for the Supreme Court has to be a vote for the president. So I get your point, and I think it's vitally important, and it's one of the reasons why it's so critical that we choose a really good person to be running for president and ultimately elected as president. But Lee, thank you for raising the issue. I appreciate the call, and great to hear from you. Thanks for listening there. Jerry in Hudson, Canada. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate all of what you've done and all of what you know and how you help us all.
Are you up on Hudson Bay, at the southern tip of Hudson Bay there by Moosonee, or is this some other Hudson?
No, this is a little town about 35 miles, a little village actually, 35 miles outside of Montreal, real close to New York.
Oh, okay.
But what I've been concerned about or thought about ever since the NAFTA and CAFTA agreements has been regarding the labor expense, and it seems to me that a logical and rational way to deal with this would be to index the labor cost. In other words, if you have a person that's sewing garments in, say, China, if you index that labor cost and then factor in the cost of hospitalization and pension expenses and index that to what would be a comparable job in the United States, factoring in, again, the same pension and hospitalization medical expenses, that if we had a factoring agenda that would go with every trade agreement, that would basically gut the cheap labor process that is so attractive to all these corporations, and consequently they would not be leaving the United States en masse, and they would have no reason because of the cheap labor costs. This seemed like a rational approach to that concept.
Well, that's what we did for 200 years. And the question then becomes, how do you enforce that index? And the way that we enforced it was with tariffs. We said, if you can make a pair of shoes in the United States with $1 worth of labor, and it takes 20 cents worth of labor to make it in China, then there's an 80-cent tariff, a tax, an import tax, when that pair of shoes hits the U.S. border. And so wherever you make the shoes, it's going to cost you $1 for your labor, whether that dollar goes to the worker or whether 80 cents of that dollar goes to the government. And, you know, it worked just fine. The problem is if you say, you know, we're going to make sure that the Chinese worker is getting the dollars worth of labor too, then that's the equivalent in China of maybe, you know, $45 an hour. And that's going to totally throw their economy into chaos. They wouldn't allow that, and it wouldn't work, frankly. So tariffs, I mean, there's a reason why China charges tariffs on imports into China from countries that have cheaper labor than China does. And there's a reason why most countries in the world use tariffs to regulate their commerce. And there's a reason why we did from the founding of this republic up until relatively recently. I mean, we still have over 20,000 tariffs in place, and the average of them is about 2% right now. 40 years ago, the average tariff into the United States was around 20%.
Well, but what I'm saying is that if a person in China has to work an hour sewing dresses, and then they can go out and at the end of that hour and buy X number of gallons of milk or whatever, and then a person that works in the United States works an hour and they go out and buy the same amount in American dollars, whereas the disparity in the value of their payment in the United States and China would be dissipated. And not necessarily a flat tariff, but I mean an indexed labor cost job.
But how does that work? Let's say we're talking about somebody making garments, and you know, let's use the shoe analogy. You've got somebody in China who right now is working. If we wanted to make the shoes in the United States and pay somebody a living wage, it would cost a dollar per pair of shoes because they could make, let's say, you know, 15 or 20 pairs of shoes an hour. So it would be a dollar or shoes an hour. So it'd be a dollar per shoe for the labor here in the United States. In China right now at, you know, 30 cents an hour, it's a dime's worth of labor in that pair of shoes. If you want them to be able to have a lifestyle equivalent to our lifestyle, that is, you know, buy groceries for their family, own a car, own a home, maybe have a pension, that 10 cents worth of labor might become 30 or 40 cents worth of labor. How does that help the American worker compete with the Chinese worker?
Well, it wouldn't. There would be no competition. They would be able to hold the same standard of living in China that they would here in the United States. Consequently, there would be no advantage to a corporation to move their labor offshore because
because it's going to cost them fewer dollars to buy that Chinese labor. I mean, it helps the Chinese laborers to have a better standard of living, but it's still costing less. The labor costs there are lower. And frankly, it's just a function of, you know, they've got a billion people. There's no shortage of people who are willing to work for less money.
Okay, well, it was just a thought.
Yeah, maybe I'm missing something here, Jerry. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how do you implement it. This is something that, you know, our governments all around the world have struggled with for thousands of years. I mean, tariffs go back at the time of Gilgamesh, the Sumerian Empire, 7,000 years ago, was using tariffs. The Egyptians used tariffs. Rome used tariffs. The Greeks used tariffs.
It's not a tariff per se. It's an indexing of labor cost on an individual.
Right, but then you're saying to another country, you must pay this in labor, and they're going to say, hey, what do we just do? Surrender our sovereignty? We don't have control over that.
Well, then we won't buy those goods if they're not paid. You know, if your labor cost is not comparable to what we're paying here.
Yeah, interesting idea. Jerry, thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I hear the drums of war, they are changing. And everybody's getting in the groove. Laughing and dancing and talking and jamming and singing. We got nothing but love to prove. How about you? Everything's okay in the USA, in the good old USA.
Rudy Giuliani's running a new ad, a new radio ad, in New Hampshire and Iowa, and perhaps in a few other states, in which he points out that he had prostate cancer 5 years ago. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And he says that the survival for prostate cancer in the U.S. is 82%, but in England with socialized medicine, it's 44%, and therefore, isn't he glad he lives in America and doesn't have socialized medicine because he's still alive? It's a lie. If you go to cancerresearchuk.org, you can find the stats for prostate cancer survival. And for a man Rudy Giuliani's age in the United Kingdom, the survival rate in the United Kingdom, in the United States it's 82%, in the United Kingdom it's 83%. 83%. Giuliani lies in his ad. Let that be on the record. The website cancerresearchuk.org. And this is statistics from 2000-2001. This is not something that went up last week in response to Rudy Giuliani's lying ad. Check it out. Debbie in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Debbie, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You're just fabulous, and I've learned a lot, and I've become a lot more active after listening to your program. I'm sorry to go back to your previous subject, but just very briefly so I can understand and speak better to it. I live in a very conservative community. I live a little bit outside of L.A. Back to the tariffs. I listen to you, and I understand your basic premise about the cost of labor and adjusting for the dollar of labor versus 10 cents in China through tariff. But I want to understand, is if we were to go back to more tariffs and adjusting in that manner, is there any incentive left for a company to still, say, do have any manufacturing, say, in China? Or would it even it out? I mean, because don't they have to pay then the tariff? So,
right.
Coming back in.
What would happen is that millions of manufacturing jobs would come back to the United States. The only reason that we've made shoes in the United States, which we pretty much don't anymore, for 200 years, is because there were tariffs that kept the shoe industry here. The only reason we made clothes in the United States for hundreds of years was because we had tariffs that kept the clothing industry here. It just goes right on down the board.
No, I understand that point, and that's marvelous. I just wanted to be clear on that because I thought I'd heard in the next conversation, and I must have misunderstood, that you were telling your last caller, no, there would still be incentive for companies to go to China even if we had tariffs, and
I think the caller was saying was that the government, through some sort of mechanism, and I don't want to mischaracterize what he was saying, but what I've heard some people say is that the government, through some sort of mechanism, should be telling businesses what they can and cannot buy. And I don't think that that's right. I think that that's too much government control and involvement in the marketplace, and it won't work. But what the government can say is, you're welcome to buy stuff from China if you want, but you're going to have to pay an import tax on it that is going to make it equivalent, that it's going to make it so that you might as well make it here because it's going to cost you the same regardless of where you make it. And that's, not only did we do that for 200 years in the United States, but 100% of the federal government's revenue, all of the money that paid for the salaries from George Washington until Abraham Lincoln, from the founding of this country to the Civil War, 100% of all federal revenues came from tariffs. Two-thirds of all federal revenues from the end of the Civil War until World War I came from tariffs. One-third of all federal revenues after World War I, we got the income tax and the size of government pretty much tripled over about a 20-year period. One-third of the cost of the federal government from World War I to World War II came from tariffs. So tariffs were a really important, not just source of revenue, but also as a way of keeping domestic manufacturing. Now, there are some things where we would look at them and we would say, we want people to import these things. We don't have a domestic sandalwood industry in the United States. And if people want to buy a carved sandalwood statue from Thailand, or if they want to buy, Chinese pottery that's, particularly uniquely made in China, you'd have a low tariff on those things. So that we can have the benefits of international trade. We can get, things that they make in German cuckoo clocks, that are made in the Black Forest. Why would you want to have a high tariff on those? We don't have a cuckoo clock industry here that we're trying to protect. So you do it strategically. You do it intelligently. And every other country in the world, by the way, is still doing this today.
I think that last point is extremely important, and it's typical of the way you were able to explain things and bring it full circle and really educate your listeners. And that was the point I was looking for, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, the idea of selective tariffs. What we wouldn't otherwise manufacture here, we can still keep a low tariff on, if any.
Oh, absolutely, Debbie, absolutely. In fact, that was the argument that Adam Smith made in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, that if one country makes good cheese, one country makes good wine, one country makes good sweaters, they should have very low barriers to trade between them. But if two of those countries are both making cheese, then they might want to start protecting their domestic industries. Debbie, I got to run. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Michael, we have just a little less than a minute before we have to wrap the show. I'll give you the last.
Thank you so much. I just blogged on this recently, where I think a good idea, since we have such a demand here in the United States, we buy all sorts of crap. Why can't we tell the companies that if they want to do business here in the United States, they need to have a certain percentage of the labor in the United States as well. And at the same
Because that's over-regulating companies. You just do it economically. You just say, that's fine. If you want to bring stuff in from the outside the United States, that's fine. Just pay us a tax on it. And at that point, they'll look at it and say, well, okay, it's not worth it.
I don't know. I think we need to tell people they have to do business here in the United States.
But then you're enforcing
labor.
It
they
with
need to have labor.
But then No, I understand that, but then you're enforcing it basically with guns and jails and things, and that frankly is coercive, and that's beyond what I'm, you know, my boundaries. But Michael, it's a thought, but I think the tariffs. I mean, you know, it worked for 200 years. So the first tariffs were put in place in the United States in 1787, and 1787, and they've worked for a long, long time. Tomorrow, Yaron Brook is going to tell us why to get rid of Social Security. That'll be great fun. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.